Father Mitch Papua, and welcome to EWTN Live, where we bring you guests from around the world. Tonight, we'll talk about a new graduate-level college program designed to help students learn and speak the truth of the Catholic faith into the conversation around gender identity, as well as deal with other issues in our society. Before we get to that, I want to talk briefly with EWTN's John Elson about a new EWTN original movie, which will debut this weekend. John, what you got for us?
Good to see you, Father. Well, thank you. I want to let our EWTN family at home know that this Saturday, May 31st at 8 p.m. Eastern, we'll be premiering a new original movie about St. John Vianney entitled The Curé of Ars. Curé is the French term for pastor. And the Curé, as I'll mention in a moment, is just one of the greatest pastors in the history of France. He was born in 1786 in Catholic France, 3 years before the very sinister French Revolution that came to France in 1789. The goal, one of their goals, was not just to overthrow the monarchy, but to destroy the Catholic faith. And during those years, all Catholic churches were closed, masses were banned. Many priests and nuns were martyred. And the Curé's family, a devout Catholic family, despite the risks, not only did they practice their Catholic faith, but sheltered priests. And as years went by, he felt his own calling to the priesthood, despite some academic challenges, became a priest, and in 1818, the bishop assigned him to the village of Ars. This was a small town in eastern France with only 240 people, but they had four taverns. And it was famous for three things: drinking, fighting, and dancing. And so these dances were very licentious moments in the taverns, and it was something that he really wanted to eradicate. So as he became the parish priest, he began an intense life of prayer, penance, and fasting. He said the curtailing of food, drink, and sleep are the best spiritual weapons we have. He also used a discipline on himself. A discipline is a small whip with small iron edges that he used to take on the sins of the people. Pastorally, his number one goal to start was to restore the beauty of the church. So to bring back beautiful vestments, he had some wealthy people both inside and outside of Ars donate funds for that. He'd also would preach very strong sermons. He would urge the faithful that were there to come to confession, come to communion, come to Jesus, live from him in order to live for him. Mm-hmm. And he wouldn't just preach to the people at Mass. He would go out into the village and visit every single family, usually at lunchtime, because that's when they all were available. And he would have time not only to interact with them, but he would even work the fields with them. He would help younger members of the family discern vocations to different professions. He would also start a school for many of the unfortunately abandoned children who were abandoned by their parents because of their licentious lifestyle. And for 40 years, he had daily catechism classes because he believed that religious ignorance was one of the greatest obstacles to conversion. Mm-hmm. And finally, as many have heard, he had hours in the confessional, many hours in the confessional, could read souls. And what happened over the years, because of his pastoral attentiveness and his zeal for the souls of his faithful, Ars turned from a place of great poverty and depravity to great prosperity and even pilgrimage. Towards the end of his life, hundreds of thousands, 120,000 to be exact, pilgrims came from throughout France and outside of France to come to Ars.
So his story, even had to run a special train.
Even a special train, 80,000 people a year would just take the public transport. So we're really honored and grateful to our EWTN family for giving us the support to produce this original movie. And I think it gives us all hope, not only for parish priests and seminarians, but each of us. And it shows us and tells us and gives us the hope that our prayers and penances can have great fruit, not only for our own conversion, but for our family members, friends, and those of the entire world.
Good. All right. Thank you, John. Be sure to watch the EWTN original movie, The Curé d'Ars. It's on Saturday, May 31st at 8 p.m. Eastern Time. It'll be repeated on Monday, June 2nd. At 1:30 a.m. Eastern Time on EWTN. We'll be back in just a minute or so with tonight's guest, so please stay with us. Thanks, John. Welcome back. Tonight, we want to address the cultural conflicts that have America and the world over deeply divided people regarding fundamental questions of human identity. These challenges show up in areas like education, law, medicine, public policy, and even within the church. To help foster and guide this conversation, last year, the Nesty Center for Faith and Culture at the University of St. Thomas in Houston, Texas, launched a new graduate program in Catholic Women's and Gender Studies, which grounds Catholic students and others in a Catholic understanding of human personhood, and also explores its meaning and application to our contemporary circumstances. Here to tell us more about it is the director of the Nesty Center for Faith and Culture at the University of St. Thomas in Houston. Please welcome Dr. Kevin Stewart. Dr. Stewart, welcome. Good to have you here in Alabama.
My pleasure, Father.
And you're not only the head of this Nesty Center, but also you're teaching in it as well, correct?
That's right.
What do you see as the issues that you have to address and you want to address with your students?
Well, you mentioned our new program in Catholic Women's and Gender Studies, and I think it's a great example of the kind of thing that we want to do.
Yes.
And need to be doing as a church.
Yes.
As the people of God. And that is that we have something to contribute to the most pressing conversations in our culture today.
Mm-hmm.
That we do have to say no to error, but eventually you can't beat something with nothing. You got to have something to offer in its place. And so we are going to be about laying, and we are in our classes already, laying out the positive vision. The church has quite a lot to say about what it means to be a man and what it means to be a woman and what it means to be a human person. And so this program is a terrific program, getting national attention, getting high caliber students from all over the country. Because it's online, synchronous online, meaning kind of like a Zoom call, it means that we can recruit the best caliber faculty from all across the country as well.
Nice.
So we're not limited geographically on the mm-hmm. on the faculty, so we can just go out and get the very best people speaking the truth about these matters with the conviction that all truth is God's truth,
mm-hmm.
and therefore all truth is one. And so we have nothing to fear from good science, good philosophy, good thinking generally.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
a lot to fear from any of it done poorly.
That I think is a key thing. And you know, our culture is opting for a lot of things that denigrate human dignity, and yet they insist on fighting in favor of these things. I oftentimes compare this to a dog with a bone, that our culture has these old bones in its mouth, and if you try to take it away from that dog, he's going to bite you. But if you have a steak, he just opens his mouth and drops that bone and goes for the steak. Well, we have a Catholic steak. There's a Catholic understanding of humanity that we need to present so that they drop some of this culture of death and these other elements of anger and depression. And this is some of the things that we were talking earlier today, that you find that there's an inverse relationship between the comfort and wealth in our culture and the well-being of the culture. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, it's fitting in a way that we're having this conversation on the birthday of Walker Percy, 20th century novelist born here in Birmingham, Alabama.
Yes.
And one of the most insightful thinkers about the human condition in our era. And you're right that the larger context in which all of this occurs, and what really got me started down this road, is what I call the materialist's paradox. And that paradox is actually rather simple. And it is that by any fair reckoning, we Americans are some of the most materially wealthy people ever to walk the earth.
Yeah, I oftentimes would tell my students, the pharaohs had big pyramids, and they had very nice jewels and lots of gold, but they never had air conditioning. And it's hot in Egypt, 130, 140 degrees hot, and they had no air conditioning.
Yes.
So we're much more comfortable.
We are, and yet, as has gained national attention in recent years, anxiety, loneliness, depression, all of these are dramatically increasing, even suicide, the most extreme examples here. So why aren't we happy? If we're so wealthy and getting wealthier,
mm-hmm.
why aren't we happy?
Yes.
And I think it's bad that we're in that situation, but what a moment for the church to step in and say, well, it's because we're not just material beings.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a material sickness or problem that we're suffering from, it's a spiritual problem.
And we have a number of forces in culture that say it is about, you know, having wealth, and you know, if you have the material needs and if you evenly distribute, then everybody will be happy. But even except for the very poorest, who are mostly poor because of drug use and a few other problems. But even what we call our poor people are better off than middle-class people I knew in Peru, you know, years ago. So we're well off, but still not at peace. And the Marxist point of view doesn't fit.
Yes. Well, I tell my students sometimes that my job as a social scientist, as a political scientist, is to tell you things you already know, but with numbers. And there's actually some really good data and good research that's been done that supports your general point that if you're already pretty happy and you get more money, then you get happier, oftentimes because you're giving it away and blessing other people with it.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're unhappy and you get more money, it doesn't make you happy, right?
Mm-mm.
Because the money is kind of beside the point, right? There's other stuff going on. So we've done some of our own research at the Center for Faith and Culture at the University of St. Thomas on happiness, replicating some earlier studies, meaning redoing them and updating them and adding certain questions and taking certain limitations out, trying to improve the studies. And what we found is that there are four basic factors that close the gap between the Americans who report the highest levels of flourishing and happiness, and the Americans who report the lowest levels of flourishing and happiness.
So what would be these four things?
Prepare to be shocked, Father.
Okay.
The first is marriage. A strong marriage is core to happiness even today.
Okay, that's out.
Church participation. People who go to church are happier than people who don't.
I'm in on that, okay.
Meaningful work, that there is something, and again, the church is way ahead on this from Laborum Exercens, Rerum Novarum. We have a long tradition of thinking carefully about the meaning of work, that it's not just what we do to eat, though we do need to eat, and we do need to earn some money to do that. But there's a lot more to work, and there is meaning to work, and there had better be. So meaningful work is one of them.
And we even set up not only St. Joseph as the patron saint of workers, but we have patron saints of almost every different kind of career that's, you know, been in the world, because we have saints coming from different kinds of work, and we make them patrons because Peter was a fisherman, and Saint Hubert was a hunter, and you had Saint Isidore the farmer, and so we have sanctity that's associated with work.
Yeah, and supporting that is we have social science that goes behind that to say that, to show that when we are reflective like that about our work, when we associate our work with the holiness of saints, it kind of elevates the work, what it means. We're clear about how we're benefiting other people and humanity and our own families, and that actually makes the work better for us. So
mm-hmm.
social science well done shows forth the wisdom of the church on these things.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I like pointing out, and you can see this in Houston, that the Catholic Church has even 9 patron saints for making beer. You know, so we've got everything covered.
That's right. That's right. The fourth of them, just to get all four, because we may have viewers wondering, well, what's that fourth one? The fourth one is community engagement, that we are the kind of beings who need to be in relationship closely with another human being through mm-hmm. marriage, with the Lord in the church, but then also within our community. We need to be citizens. Mm-hmm. We need to be active in our neighborhoods and in our towns.
I recently learned about a book that you know well, and people in sociology know well, called Bowling Alone. And the purpose of that study was to show that people in our culture are withdrawing from these social organizations. And he called it bowling alone because people don't even join bowling leagues anymore. They don't join church, they don't join social organizations, not the Moose, the Elks, Knights of Columbus, nothing. And they're isolating into their own individuality.
Yes, so institutions across society are in decline. Practically any institution you can think of, be it marriage or the Elks Club or a bowling league or little leagues, mm-hmm. these are all in decline. It's a general pattern that plays out across society, and it shows, right? It's not a coincidence that as that decline is happening, we have dramatic increases in loneliness. We have dramatic increases in the mental health problems associated with isolation and loneliness. And we have social and community decay.
Yeah, yeah. And I've also recently read a book that there are particular problems for boys. Boys seem to be especially, you know, isolated, and they're not joining boys' groups and hanging out with other boys, and they're finding themselves dissociated in a lot of ways, even more so even than girls. So there are specific problems, but all kinds of problems that come from lacking marriage. Again, 52% of our children are born to unmarried people, and lacking meaningful work, lacking social groups. These are very important.
Yeah, I mean, talk about telling you things you already know, but with numbers, there's very strong research that the best outcomes for children are achieved in homes with a married mother and father. When they grow up, it turns out that human beings need a mama and they need a daddy.
And mamas and daddies need each other. They live longer and are happier as well, are they not?
Oh yes. So more than your cholesterol level, more than your blood sugar, more than your blood pressure, more than just about any other health indicator that there is, the best predictor of longevity, and I think this is just astonishing, the best predictor of a long, healthy life is actually not any of those physical markers, but rather the quality of your close relationships, friendships, and especially marriage relationships.
And one of the factors that you also mentioned, going to church adds about 5 years to a life. You know, there are consistent studies showing that regular attendance at church makes a huge difference. But we have people today who won't even baptize their own children, let alone take them to church.
Yes, so marriage as an institution and the church as an institution are very tightly tied together.
Yes.
So we have to be paying attention. We can't be paying attention to one or the other, but both and.
Yes.
Because they travel together, so much so that the best predictor of whether you will attend church as an adult regularly is whether you grew up in a home with two married parents.
Yeah.
If you did, then you're more likely to to attend church. So if we want people in the pews 50 years from now in our Catholic parishes, and I think we do, then we have to pay attention to who's getting married now.
Now, some of your research, because this is not just how you feel, that you're basing this on not only your own research, but the research done by a lot of different people throughout the country and throughout the Western world.
Yes, there's a tremendous and growing network of scholars who are dedicated to these issues and who are now willing to say what's true, and they can demonstrate it with good quality social science. And so for a long time, I think people have falsely wanted to pit science versus religion.
Yes.
And I'm in the business of saying that the two go together. Science done really well does not contradict the truth of the faith. How could it? Yeah. Ontologically, that's not possible.
Right. And often, I mean, we don't have to go into all that, but oftentimes some of the disputes that pit religion versus science, like with Galileo, was because both the science was only partial. They still had very rudimentary, Galileo had a lot of very rudimentary notions about the Earth going around the sun, and that wasn't clear, and the church had very rudimentary notions. As science became more clear, the church had no problem. This has to be true with the social sciences as well.
Oh, even more so. I mean, you steep yourself in the science for even a modest amount of time, and you quickly realize that we human beings make a lot of errors. And we make a surprising number of basic errors over and over again. Mm-hmm. And so what you learn is, if you learn well, what you learn is a kind of humility that we should proceed cautiously. We should look for lots of studies that point in the same direction, that mm-hmm. kind of converge in some place, because that's telling us something, rather than a single blockbuster knockout study, because it can have a small flaw that totally changes all the numbers.
Well, see, that's one of the things. You have to watch for outliers. Those would be something that comes up with a study that contradicts everybody else. Now, you have to ask, is it because everybody else missed something? Or is it that the researcher missed something? But I think the bigger problem that I sense in our culture is that as a politically correct orthodoxy from the left wing of our culture forbade people to even look at some of these things or say certain truths about the necessity of marriage, then people just ignored the facts. And I'm sure you see that in your field.
Oh, yes. I mean, to go back to the example that we started with gender identity and gender dysphoria, they proceeded on very thin, shaky evidence to lock themselves into a certain protocol that now has been amply demonstrated to not be effective.
Yeah.
When addressing
what do you mean
issues.
By that?
So the protocol of puberty blockers, followed by cross-sex hormones, followed by surgical interventions regarding people who don't feel at home in their own body.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I think the importance of the Catholic approach here is first to say, anyone who, imagine how bad it would feel not to feel at home in your own body,
yeah.
to feel alienated from yeah. your own physical body.
Horrible.
Tremendous pain. And so first we must approach each and every one of these people from the standpoint of love. They are made in the image and likeness of God and destined to an endless existence with Him. But they are also ailing, and we need to figure out what will help them.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to do so honestly without the ideology that's been pushed very hard for several decades now.
Yes.
And when we do that, what we find is, of course, what we would expect to find, which is that what they need is to be reconciled to the body that they have.
Mm-hmm.
And that the best approach to do that, the problem isn't the body, it's not the body that's ill in those instances, it's the mind. So that's mm-hmm. that's one example. Antecedent to that, the larger point of our program with our master's degree is the entire context in which we really understand gender, you know, human sex and gender, what it means to be a man, what it means to be a woman, because the political problem today of gender ideology just shows it's kind of the tip of a much bigger problem, which is our terrible confusion about what it means to be a human person and a man and a woman.
In some ways, this it reminds me of the problem in economics, where people say, well, if you just give people and take care of all of their economic needs, they'll be happy. And we can see that in our extraordinarily wealthy society, that doesn't work. But similarly, if you approach someone who feels uncomfortable with themselves with a physical solution, with, you know, transgender surgeries and giving of hormones that are not made for the body that person is, you are not solving the problem of their dissatisfaction, this dysphoria about being in this body, but you're causing a physical change that long-term harms them. I mean, it reduces life expectancy by 50%. That's, they don't tell you that mm-hmm. before surgery. And we have to look, this is where our Catholicism comes in. We see that this is spiritual, psychological, and social, that we have to deal with all these levels.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one thing that's very hopeful is we're starting to wake up from these things.
Yeah.
Another thing that's very hopeful is all the things that we've been talking about tonight are things that people can address and make a strong positive impact on mm-hmm. right in their own situation, wherever they are. If
yes.
they live in a small town, if they live in a big city, if they live in a suburb, wherever they are, they can begin to have an impact on these issues that constitute human happiness in America. They can help with marriage, with church participation, with meaningful work, and with community engagement. They can get involved in all of those wherever they are.
Yeah, there's so many, just say on the community engagement level, there are so many Catholic organizations I remember growing up that the adults participated. The men were part of the Holy Name Society, women were part of the Altar and Rosary Society. There were lots of things that people did in church and outside. They did both. And it made for a stronger community, especially with faith. I'm afraid we have to take a little break. We're going to come back in a couple of minutes with questions from you. So please stay with us. Thank you. Welcome back. We are speaking to Dr. Kevin Stewart at the University of St. Thomas in Houston, Texas. And you can learn more from the NESTI Center for Faith and Culture by going to their website. It is CatholicGenderStudies.com. CatholicGenderStudies.com. And they can learn more about your program that you have at the school. I think that's a really important subject to take. All right, let's start off with a call. You have Steve in the great state of Oregon. Steve, what can we do for you?
Yes, Father. I was going to say, a transgender male feels inferior to other males, for he wants to be a woman. And how can he overcome these feelings?
So those suffering from gender dysphoria, right, and in these various situations, the best help that we have found so far is significant counseling, mm-hmm. both psychological counseling and spiritual counseling. Mm-hmm. So again, I'm gonna tell the priest something he already knows, which mm-hmm. is that what they need help with is diving into the trauma, the hurt that's really at the bottom of all of this, mm-hmm. that it's not the body that's wrong. And your caller is right. There's often a psychological feeling of vulnerability or various other issues that are going on. But the best addresses are both psychological counseling, psychotherapy, mm-hmm. but also spiritual counseling from a very good priest.
Also, there are in the studies being done on, you know, patterns of transgender children or people who feel the dysphoria. The number of them seem to have occasions of depression within their family, and the family doesn't know how to deal with that, and the kid is trying to cope because the kid feels alone as the adults try to cope with their own depression. That's one factor.
Yes, so one thing that's very helpful for anyone in a position who might come across a person suffering in this way is that there's a high degree of what in medicine are known as comorbidities. So this is when you don't have just one problem, but multiple problems.
Yes.
So there are other things going on almost invariably.
Yes.
With gender dysphoria, there are other things going on, and that's important to know because you want to be on the lookout for signs and symptoms of other problems to get the person the help that they need.
And another very common factor is that quite a number of folks seeking, you know, transgender therapy and work, a lot of them are autistic persons, and that it's not so much about the gender transition that's at stake. They have to deal with some of the other issues that are going on in their lives. Again, they're just a variety of issues taking place in life that such people have to address. And this is not something that is solved by just getting a transgender surgery and lifelong treatment with the hormone of the opposite sex.
Yes, the moment we think we've got humanity figured out and nailed cold, we should remind ourselves that we're probably very wrong. So it's somewhat mysterious why there's that tight relationship between autism spectrum disorder and gender dysphoria, but it is there in the data. Again, this is one of the many things that we're not sure about, and that's why we ought to proceed. I think common sense would tell us in these situations where there's so much that's unknown, that we proceed with great caution and don't do radical experimental things.
Right, no, until we know more what we're doing. Oh, we have a question from our studio audience. Ma'am, where are you from?
Oh, hi, I'm from Tyler, Texas.
Good to have you here, and what's your question?
Dr. Kevin, this is a graduate program, so what type of careers would they be seeking afterwards for employment?
Okay, so if someone's going to go to graduate school and work hard and get this degree, what will they do with it afterwards?
Yes, so that's a great question, mm-hmm. And I'm glad it was asked. I'm glad I didn't pay anybody to ask that, but many of our students are already working professionals. Mm-hmm. And they're working in areas where they're coming across these issues. So if you work in a Catholic school and the issue of sexuality and gender hasn't crossed your threshold, August may be when it happens, but it's going to happen sooner or later. If you work in a medical field, there's all kinds of pressure for people. And the more formed and informed they are, the better they are able to live out what their conscience tells them. So in a variety of professions where these issues come up, those are the people who are flocking to the program.
It's an important question because there are many universities that have gender studies programs, and you know, after they get a degree in gender studies, they're not really prepared to do much except teach gender studies. That's been my impression.
There are a lot of undergraduate. So ours is not an undergraduate degree, and that's
this is
that's,
a graduate and degree.
It's a graduate degree, so it assumes that someone is already a nurse or a teacher, or any of a wide variety of applications, and that the issue of that maleness and femaleness has something to do with their work.
Okay. Okay, and that would certainly be the case for school administrators, school counselors, people in the medical professions, and there'd be other
people in law.
Law, yeah, there you go. I forgot about law. That certainly would be a case where law, people who practice the law need some of this background, because there are a lot of suits of different kinds, various legal challenges of all sorts. All right, good. Thank you for that question. Ma'am, where are you from?
I am from Ohio.
Good. And your question?
My question is, I'm wondering what role Mary, Mother of God, has to play in this conflict and in this subject, especially since, as you said, it is mostly a spiritual conflict.
One of Mary, the Mother of God, is one of the great inspirations for our program. Mm-hmm. One of the reasons why these issues need to be addressed by the church and from a Catholic perspective is because within the long history of the church, we have such a wide variety of ways to be male and masculine and ways to be female and feminine. And oftentimes the ideology of today, gender ideology, often locks people in on a very sort of stereotypical, very narrow range of what it means to be masculine or feminine. Whereas we have a range from Mary and Martha to Joan of Arc to St. Edith Stein. I mean, just a tremendous variety of you know, Catherine of Siena, I could go on and on, various ways to live fully as a man, fully as a woman, in harmony with the body that you have, and that can serve as an inspiration, a sort of counter inspiration in this era. And so I think Mary plays a very important part. She's the patroness of the Americas, after all.
One of the things that I think this triggers in me is that within various parts of our culture, the church is seen as the source of sexual oppression. This is not new. This has been something thought about and taught going back to the European Enlightenment period, back in the 1600s, but mostly 1700s, when they were going through their own kind of a sexual revolution as well. And they saw the church as the enemy. And we still hear that from folks who are pushing some of the gender issues, that the church is the enemy. And there's oftentimes even not mere antagonism, sometimes outright hatred of the church. And we saw, especially in 2020, acts of violence against statues of the Blessed Virgin Mary that happened in to churches I knew, as well as other forms of vandalism, even setting churches on fire. These are, antagonisms toward the church that we also have to deal with as we confront these issues.
Yeah, so if you work for any length of time in the social sciences and with the data, you're going to come across truths that are there and well-founded, repeatedly show up over a long period of time in the data, and yet nobody talks about things you're not supposed to notice.
Yes.
Well, one of those is that relationships that conform to church teaching regarding our sexuality actually result in greater happiness.
Mm-hmm.
So married people, particularly faithful married people, report the highest levels of sexual satisfaction. Those who've only had one sexual partner ever report the highest levels of sexual satisfaction. So the church isn't telling us to do things because she doesn't love us. She's telling us to do these things because she does, because mm-hmm. she wants us to be happy, and the data bear out that she's right.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, there are, I think, again, important facts of, you know, living a good Catholic life and good Catholic marriage. For instance, one of the data that, again, you're not supposed to mention, but people who use natural family planning have a minuscule rate of divorce compared to those who use artificial birth control. It's less than 5%. You know, people who faithfully and with religious motivation use natural family planning have less than 5% divorce rate. That's remarkable compared to what the culture would say. But it speaks to another level of communication with each other that's necessary with that, and a sense of purpose in their marriage that is not just about, well, I have to have satisfaction on certain levels. No, there's a bigger issue of marriage that I promote, and that gives satisfaction and joy.
Yeah, let me tell on myself a little bit. In my work, I often find myself reflecting on the verse, "Lord, help me in my unbelief," because I come across these facts in the data, and I am surprised by them and excited to learn them and excited for other people. Mm-hmm. You know, I go and show my wife and say, "You have to see this." And then I think, well, why am I surprised? This is confirming the truth that the church has always taught.
But on the other hand, the culture constantly tells us that, no, the church is wrong on all this, and they haven't got a clue, and these celibate priests don't know anything. And so, you know, this is the case, and with that kind of barrage in the secular media against church teaching and promoting that we're more naive when the data shows we're right.
And I think we're coming upon a cultural moment that may be a pivot, that may be a turn, because I think people are tired of it.
Yeah.
And I think they know that what they've been hearing isn't true. And so now they're searching for what is. Mm-hmm. And that's why it's immensely important for institutions like the University of St. Thomas to not to fear to tread on these issues, to take on these difficult, pressing, urgent, problematic social questions.
I think, you know, it does take a certain amount of courage, because one of the problems in academia is that you need to publish articles and books in order to get tenure. But the boards of editors of the professional magazines and journals don't necessarily want data that's out there. They want their ideology supported. And that happens often enough. I've known that from medical doctors who can't get their research published, mm-hmm. even though it's good science that they have, they can't get it published because it's contrary to the ideology of and economics of, say, promoting transgender surgeries and treatments. They get silenced. And that happens, I'm sure, in the social sciences as well.
Oh, there are profound problems with methodology and social science. I wish it were the case that always just whoever has the best set of facts and the tightest research design won out. Mm-hmm. But of course, it's human beings controlling all of this.
Yes.
And we're very flawed and we're very mischievous. Mm-hmm. And so it's every bit, as you say, there's a fight. Mm-hmm. And to that extent, yes, we do need courage. And I can't fail to praise our administrators and our board at UST for letting not just myself, but lots of other scholars working on these kinds of questions and trusting us to follow the truth wherever it leads and backing us in doing so.
Yeah. We have another caller. We have Micah Lynn. Hello, Michael?
Hello, it's Michael in the whole
name. Oh, Michael in, okay.
Yeah. So we have a grandson who is 22 and in the midst of transgender confusion. So he threatened at age 13 to commit suicide if we didn't, all of us, the family, didn't start calling him a she and allow him to change his gender. So his mom took him for therapy, but what they ended up doing was giving him hormone therapy, the gender, the puberty blockers, and all of that. And we noticed, though, that when he was younger, he had a lot of autistic features. He would hide from people. He would scream a lot. And so we wondered what we could do as grandparents to help out the situation, even though we're miles and miles and miles away. And the daughter, our daughter, doesn't want to even talk about the situation. She figures she's doing the best they can with the more progressive attitude. Can you help us?
Well, the first thing I would do is, I mean, you will be in my prayers tonight. Your situation will be.
And it's going to also add, you can find him on the internet. I would like you to get in contact with the resources of a former guest I had, Dr. Quentin Van Meter, M-E-T-E-R. Dr. Quentin Van Meter. He is a pediatric endocrinologist. He's got a lot of the research done. And you may want to start consulting with him. And may not get a hold of him exactly, but certainly start to go to his resources that can give you some of the data that, you know, awakens people to the health risks and psychological risks so that you can know more specifically the data you're talking about, and not just, well, I don't like this. No, that doesn't help. You want the facts. And Dr. Van Meter and others that he works with will have that data for you to look at, and, you know, some other resources that he has available at his site. Do you have anything besides that?
Yes, so I think you're exactly right. There are networks of experts, Catholic psychotherapists, who can help. And the delicate line that parents and grandparents and loved ones are asked to walk is, on the one hand, you want and have to maintain the relationship with the person who's going through this.
Yes.
But you also have to do so in the light of the truth.
Yes.
I will say, if it's some comfort, that time is on your side. The longer that things go without the surgical interventions, the better the results at the end of that, the less likely that will come. So at the age that you're already talking about, you're pretty late in the game, so there are good reasons for hope. Keep loving them, keep praying for them, and do reach out and get formed and informed on all of the best information on these issues to help bring your loved ones along.
I would add this too, pastorally. It is very problematic that this child, as a child, had threatened suicide unless the adults around him do what he wanted. That's not a good sign. And the adults need to still have a sense, wait a minute, we're being held hostage by these strong feelings. And, you know, it's not like talking to a little kid, but that has to be addressed. And I would also pursue somebody in psychology, someone who understands some of those dynamics about very deep-seated anger this kid obviously has, but also that he's well aware that he can manipulate the adults around him. That's not good for any kid to manipulate the adults. I'm sure you see that with your
yes.
children.
I mean, this very well could have been genuine, but it's also important to know that there are scripts, so to speak, online that folks can get access to that tell them how to get the adults to do what they want. There's even a Canadian psychologist who counsels young people experiencing gender dysphoria to do exactly what was described, to threaten that mm-hmm. in order, because the adults will do whatever you want at that point.
Yep, yeah, because you scare them, the kid scares them. Mm-hmm. And that's something that is really bad for the kid, as well as for the adults helping them make decisions. You may want to look up some of those websites to know what they say ahead of you. Like my fellow Chicago citizen Al Capone said, keep your friends closer and your enemies closer still. So you may want to find out what some of those websites say. Again, I urge you to take and learn more about the University of St. Thomas in Houston. Just go to stthom.edu. That's STTHOM.edu. And also the Nesty Center for Faith and Culture, CatholicGenderStudies.com. Hopefully your program will address some of these questions about what to do with threats of suicide and stuff. These are great sources to find out and maybe enroll in the program if this is something applicable to you. Thank you very much for coming here, Dr. Stewart. We appreciate it very much. And we appreciate all of you. May Almighty God bless you all and keep you and cause His face to shine upon you and lead you in all of your ways by His peace. May Almighty God bless you, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen. And this network is brought to you by you. We can do this program and all the other programs only because of your support. So please remember to keep us in between your gas bill, your electric bill, and your cable bill. And then we'll be able to pay all of our bills too. God bless you all, and thank you.